Happy New Year, everyone, and I am joined with Dr. Greg Sadler, who's becoming kind of a frequent guest on this podcast. I think that for this year, for 2018, I have recorded almost an episode a month. 2017, I launched this podcast. Maybe 2019 will be the year that this turns into a weekly thing. So I definitely appreciate Dr. Sadler being here. The Congress, a new Congress, is taking their seats this year. I'm not sure exactly which Congress this is. I probably should know what the 100 and something Congress, but you know, as far as that goes, no matter what Congress this is, last time Dr. Sadler was with us, we were talking about the upcoming election and what was going on there. We know that we've got, you know, a period, we're in the middle of a period of polarization that's just really beyond anything we've seen since the 1850s. There was someone who actually I saw on Twitter that said, well, the nation's been polarized before. Just remember when Preston Brooks caned Charles Sumner in the 1850s. And I responded, I said, well, yeah, we had a civil war a few years after that. So hopefully there's some kind of solution to this and some kind of road out of this political polarization and animosity that Americans seem to have for each other than going into a civil war kind of situation. So, Greg, thanks for joining us. And just in case somebody's tuning in for the first time, tell us about yourself and your endeavors and let people know how to find you.
Well, I'm a philosophy professor, although I teach now part-time for several institutions, including Marquette and the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design. I was a full-time academic in the past and then transitioned into more of an entrepreneurial mindset and started my own business, which you can find at reasonio.com. Also, you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, and of course, there's my YouTube channel. Just type in Gregory B. Sadler, and that's one of the first things that comes up. Now, you mentioned doing a weekly podcast. That's ambitious, so I applaud you for trying to take that on. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, we'll see. It's of course it's less work than making a YouTube video in a lot of cases, and maybe I'll, you know, try to get to twice a month and then kind of keep ratcheting that up. I find that if I gradually increase the frequency, it seems to be working for me. But you know, as far as this goes, what we decide to talk about here is I saw something on Greg's Twitter a few months ago, actually, Philosopher70 on Twitter, and he tweeted something about, it was an article about Alexis de Tocqueville. Now, a lot of us who teach have encountered Alexis de Tocqueville, who was the author of Democracy in America. He's also written, wrote a history of the French Revolution, at least a partial one, and also just other travel journals. He went to England and Ireland, and he wrote about it. He was really one of the first tourists, a French aristocrat who just went around and saw a lot of stuff outside his country and sent people, you know, wrote these things so that people in France can see, oh, that's what America's like. That's what England and Ireland are like. And a lot of us have encountered excerpts from de Tocqueville's work, but we haven't necessarily been introduced to de Tocqueville, the philosopher, because, I mean, he had a very philosophical approach to what he was writing. And where is this coming from? And that's where having Dr. Sadler here is helpful to us, because I want to just look at who was this guy? And in general, what kind of advice does he have today that would be useful for Americans in the situation that we're finding ourselves in now? So, Greg, what do you have to say about that?
Well, de Tocqueville is a very interesting person as a philosopher, but also as you might say, a practical man of letters. He's from an aristocratic family in a time when, you know, there were people who were very suspicious of aristocracy in France. He's born after the Revolution. He winds up being a bureaucrat for a while, and his original pitch to come to America was to check out the prison system. And that's you know, that produces one of his first books, this report on the prison system in America, because the French were very interested in that. But you're right, he's looking at things from a philosophical perspective, or let's say philosophically informed perspective, because it wasn't as if you, you know, rigorously distinguished philosophy from history, from literature, from rhetoric at the time. He had no intention of, say, becoming a university professor. He was trying to write works that would actually make some sort of impact. And so, you know, he produces, along with his friend Beaumont, who he traveled with, this report on the prison system, and then writes, you know, Democracy in America a bit later, just a few years later. And Beaumont himself also writes some, as yet, I think, untranslated works on America, more interested in race relations than in the things that the Tocqueville is concerned with. He's part of a movement that is trying to understand this new phenomenon of democracy, which is taking radically different shape in, say, France or in these German states than it is in America, or also in Britain, where you had this entire, you know, aristocratic class system sort of holding things back. And so he's doing a lot of comparative political analysis, but he's trying to look at it in terms of, well, let me give you an example. He begins volume two of Democracy in America by observing that Americans are the people who most embody Descartes' precepts but don't actually read Descartes. And so what was Descartes known for? Doubting everything. You know, this sort of corrosive effect of calling everything into question. And now Descartes said, well, you know, you do that on an individual level. Don't try to do this. Don't tear down the whole kingdom, follow the rules, and just build things up on your own. But the Americans are doing that in a different way. And he was very concerned with what he saw as the positive effects of democracy turning bad in one way or another. And he thought that there were two different models, American democracy, and what made American democracy was not so much the way the political system was organized. It wasn't just sort of, you know, playing around with the rules or the structure. It was all the other stuff that went into it. So he's using very important sort of high-level analyses in terms of the effects of equality or the desire for freedom. But he's also looking at case studies. He's looking at his travel through America as a case study. And there are many things that he left out. And, you know, he's writing this in the 1830s. So, you know, great example. You know, he didn't see the American Civil War at the time that he's writing this. I think he thought America was going to work through most of its problems without any sort of violent revolution, which is, I think, what he would have called the Civil War. But in many respects, the things that he identifies are on point, and some of them are still applicable today. There's places where he doesn't, say, emphasize class enough, or he's perhaps unduly optimistic, but there's a lot of great cautions about where democracy can go off the rails, as I think it has in our case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and that's something that, you know, from a historical perspective, and you kind of mentioned this already in a sense, but France in the 1830s was a constitutional monarchy. And so, you know, between 1815 and 1848, and then, of course, a few more years as a republic, and then the Second French Empire. So yeah. Even though France had a legislature, it wasn't the same thing as what we had in the United States. And of course, the British Parliament at the time was you had to have property requirements to vote, which had been the case in the United States in the 1790s. But by the 1830s, all of those requirements had gone away. And then, of course, when all of those requirements go away, the end result was Andrew Jackson, who, according to my reading, de Tocqueville wasn't really personally impressed with Andrew Jackson as someone that was fit to lead a country. You know, he said that the enlightened portions of the population all were, you know, were overwhelmingly against him, where he did have this very popular mass appeal. And of course, you know, we have a lot of people today who were afraid of the situation right now in the United States, but I guess they wouldn't be the first to encounter American democracy and recoil at least a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to recoil, too, when you have, say, class privileges or something that are going to be impugned by the incoming administration. And you know, I think it's important to remember as well that de Tocqueville is writing at a time when he can recognize that Africans through slavery and Native Americans through the entire, you know, reservation and treaty system were being terribly abused. And he saw that as a major set of issues that were going to have to be addressed eventually. And Jackson, you know, certainly didn't help with any of that. The sort of, you know, white American populism that Jackson appealed to was part of that. And then he's also writing before the massive waves of immigration from Europe that are going to end up being so divisive as well. And, you know, had he written in 1870, he might have written a rather different report, I suppose. But he, you know, he's working with the America that he can see at the time. And another thing that's left out, he is writing at a time when manufacturing is becoming a major concern and starting to transform things. But he didn't have any idea of what, you know, the late capitalism that we live in today would look like. You know, but you can take the thing that he's saying and adapt them. So, for example, he thinks that free associations, voluntary associations, are incredibly important within the American character. And this is something that I think has been on the decline considerably over the last several generations. And within them, both the things that are non-political and the ones that are political, we learn how to develop as human beings who can govern and be governed. We you might say, fully develop our human potential within organizations. And he thought that was quite important. He didn't see just how important the workplace ones would be, though. And he thought that is a really interesting observation. Immediately after talking about that, he talks about newspapers, and he says, newspapers are the only way in which people can have this sort of association, because how else can you communicate with thousands of people? Now, you know, what are we doing right now? This podcast will probably be downloaded and listened to by thousands of people, and they'll talk about it and respond about it. So we have a wide spectrum of media options instead, and some of them are used for producing new, largely virtual organizations and associations within which people can do the same sort of thing, take on leadership roles, work on committees, you know, develop things over time, develop new ways of organization, and thereby develop as human beings. Now, he didn't foresee that, but you can take his ideas about the relation between association of people who are largely equal to each other within that association and the need to communicate with each other through media, and you can bring it up to date to today. But then you can also see some of the problems with it. You know, Facebook and many other websites can be used as tools of essentially mass propaganda and indoctrination. You know, we talk about these silos, or you're talking about polarization, or we could just say faction, if we want to be very political about it. Those are often reflected in the media sources that people consume. You know?
And I think that also, if we're comparing what we see now with then, of course, in the 1830s, it was really kind of the beginning of the decline of the Masons. You had the Anti-Masonic Party, which formed in 1832. And so you're starting, I mean, with that founding generation, a lot of people were in those kinds of organizations, those organizations elect leaders, and they have, this fraternal element. element. Whereas when you look at social media, there's really never any kind of election. There are no credentials. The person doesn't have a voice because of their standing in the community, but maybe because of clever marketing, they said something that resonated with people. And so we build these things kind of de facto, as far as that goes. I mean, I can speak to some of my own experience that, you know, for several years, I went to the AP European History reading. And for the first few years that I did it, I was just, you know, a person in that community. But I never did anything to work my way up or anything like that in that hierarchy that exists in that organization. But I did create a YouTube channel. And that, you know, because of that,
yeah,
people there knew who I was. And it seemed like that was a little bit of a destabilizing influence in a way, because, you know, here I can come in there and all of a sudden I'm seen as an expert in this subject and somebody whose opinion is worthwhile, but not necessarily because anybody placed me in a position in the community. So this, you know, you've talked about the idea before of stasis. You know, I wonder, does our internet culture make that difficult? Because when people emerge as spokespeople for different causes, it's not because there was some sort of organized thing. And in my case, you know, and I see you've got your recording stuff behind you there. I mean, I'm just sitting here alone in my basement. And so when I speak to people, it's not as part of a community, but just here, I'm putting that out there. And I don't know if that gets the same kind of effect when everybody is subject to the same rules of the organization and works their way up. Kind of like what we've seen, like I read an article a while back about why is it that Europeans have had several female prime ministers and the United States has never had a woman president, that it's not so much our culture as our political institutions, that we've created this presidency that you run for it in a democratic sense. It's like you get out there, you tell people what they want to hear, you scare people about the opponent, and whoever is most effective at using media and whoever has the most charisma wins. Whereas in a parliamentary system, the way that women do politics, it's like a woman showing herself to be a capable manager and administrator, like Angela Merkel. Like she'd never be elected president of the United States. Theresa May wouldn't stand a chance. I mean, neither one of them is a very charismatic figure, but in those parliamentary systems, they worked their way up and gained the respect of their colleagues.
Well, you have to do that to some degree. I mean, I'm not talking about just like the race for the president, but all the other things you have to do to, like, you know, get yourself positioned for that for decades in advance. You have to, you know, schmooze and make friends and do a lot of the ins and outs of maneuvering and legislating and you know, it certainly doesn't hurt to be charismatic, but there's plenty of people who seem to make their way through the system. Now, can they successfully win a party nomination and then successfully win for president? We got very close with Hillary Clinton. I think you could actually make an argument that if her campaign hadn't made a lot of foolish decisions about, you know, places like where I live, you know, that Wisconsin doesn't need a visit.
Yeah,
we probably would have a woman president,
right? And this is a state that had shown that it was capable of electing a Republican governor. So you know, you would think that okay, with the demographics in that state, yeah, given that they've got a Republican governor, might want to do that. But then again, what ended up happening is, I mean, when you look at the things that you've said, and in the case of President Trump, he went through, I mean, there is definitely a path, because I have to explain to younger people that when I was an 8-year-old in the 1980s, I knew who Donald Trump was. He was that rich guy who was getting divorced from his wife, who did casinos or whatever. But he made this unconventional path to the presidency, which has, you know, prompted some people, you know, to still 2 years later, just not really accept the legitimacy of that election because it was so unconventional.
And it led to some on the other side saying, well, we should do that too. Let's run Oprah, or let's run The Rock, or somebody else like that, which probably is a terrible idea.
Well, yeah, or this Beto guy who's got, like, what, 3 terms in the House of Representatives under him,
well,
but...
I mean, he would be similar to Obama then, because Obama was really nobody until he came up very, very quickly through Illinois machine politics.
Yeah.
And he was the right guy at the right time. They ran him against Alan Keyes. And then from there, he could sort of, you know, move in. And a lot of things were coming together at the right time, I think, for him. Unfortunately for Hillary Clinton, whose wishes were very much stymied at that point, because if he hadn't been the candidate, she would have been the candidate, you know.
Yeah, and then again, I guess when you're looking at, you know, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, even George W. Bush, it's like they've got these, you know, these credentials, you know, even Ronald Reagan.
The gubernatorial.
Even Reagan went from...
George H.W. didn't have that, right? He was vice president, so that...
Yeah, so he had vice president, but he was also, you know, a veteran. He had led the CIA. He'd also been the head of the Republican National Committee, which I didn't know until I was listening to some random Nixon tapes, and it said, oh, yeah, he's the head of the RNC. So, you know, this guy, I mean, he... And also, when we think about, like, classical Republicanism, George H.W. Bush came from that patrician pedigree.
Yes. That used to be
something that was valued, which it's kind of the irony, because so many people, you know, left of center, they've been honoring George H.W. Bush so much because he's not Trump, but he really does represent an era of politics that a lot of people, especially in progressive circles, would find repugnant. You know, this is basically like the elite man works his way up and, you know, then takes over, and you've really got it. I mean, he's really kind of our last, like, elite figure in politics, because, you know, his son definitely kind of took a more like, okay, I'm wearing boots.
He was more like Clinton, yeah. Yeah, I think that dynamic of selectively lauding figures from the other side so that you can show up the current figure from the other side. I see both sides doing that pretty frequently these days. And to me, this is sort of a soapbox of my own. I very much highly value moral consistency. If you take a stand on this in one place, you should take a similar stand in the other. And I see both sides as playing very fast and loose with that. And I think they rely on Americans not having much of a cultural memory anymore.
If he was so great, I mean, he didn't get reelected. You know, I mean, that's the thing. And of course, you know, you want to memorialize someone when they die. And I mean, the man lived a great life, and I don't, you know, I don't fault him for any of that. But at the same time, when it comes down to it, I don't think he's going to go down in history as one of the greatest presidents of the United States. But then, you know, not only with him, but you saw how, you know, the media was latching on to, oh, even George W. Bush is now kind of a saint. And those of us who remember the, you know, it's like there's a lot of anti-Trump sentiment, but at the same time that I had to explain to my kids a few weeks ago, I said, Bush did 9/11. Y'all know it is a meme, but back when Bush was president, there were a lot of people who were seriously claiming this sort of thing. You know, for the kids, they say this to each other because it's funny. They're just like, Bush did 9/11, and they laugh.
Being ironic, yeah.
Right. And the thing is that wasn't always ironic. And so as far as that goes, though, I think that yes, I mean, in some ways, and of course, the right and the left can't really see the other side that clearly. When I look at it, I think that, you know, this process did, it to some extent, start with Barack Obama, because, you know, it was somebody with limited experience, more charismatic, and, you know, going against the political establishment. So it's like Hillary Clinton had this pedigree, and then, you know, the Democrats said, no, we want Obama. And then Obama ran against somebody with a pedigree, long tradition of public service, and defeated that person. And then you've got the Republicans come back with Donald Trump. And then the Democrats, at this point, they're like, you know, anybody, any celebrity, any politician that shows some charisma, even with limited experience, we'll put anybody, we're willing to put anybody in this office in order to gain power. And that's not exclusive to one side. So what does this, are there any warnings about the future of American democracy in the sense that Are we looking at a situation where we no longer really are able to vet the president?
I would say, I mean, from de Tocqueville's point of view, I think he would be less worried about the presidency as such. Although we can talk about, you know, the notion of soft despotism, and but that's more about administrative culture than the single person of the president. I think he'd be much more worried about the fact that on local levels, both parties are pretty gutted. And there's so much, in a way, the focus upwards, you know, on we got to win elections. That's really what has put the Democrats into the position that they're in now, where they should have a majority in a lot of places and don't because of gerrymandering. Which went against them. Now, it's not that Democrats don't gerrymander when they're given the chance, but some of the gerrymandering that Republicans have done, like in this state of Wisconsin, is just disgusting. And I say that as a registered independent. And the fact that they're willing to double down on it over and over again, that's another sign of political corruption and what de Tocqueville would have called vice. And when at the local level that becomes the norm, this sort of the party's right, you know, so long as we keep the Dems out or so long as we keep the Republicans out, we're doing the right thing. It stands in the way of developing the kind of virtue that de Tocqueville saw in the America of his time. And he thought that this happened through things like fair play. You know, with it, you know, I don't think he only had in mind things like, you know, academic associations or sort of high level political associations. He talks about organizations of every sort, even frivolous organizations. Like, you know, think about people back when we were kids who were, you know, trading pogs back and forth, you know, now a totally worthless thing. But there's probably still some people that have a group about that and talk about it and get really worked up about it. So long as you're actually working within some sort of matrix of interpersonal relations where you have to deal with other people and figure out what other people want and need, and you can't just manipulate them. And the Tocqueville, and there's certain things that are respected, like fair play, you know, the better person actually winning. De Tocqueville thinks that that's because America had such a strong interlocking tissue of that sort of thing. That's what actually made us a great people. I think that's been really eroded, both in a non-political sense. You know, you can think about that book Bowling Alone, right? And what it was diagnosing, this individualism, which is the word that he uses, by the way, over and over again in Democracy in America. When you have these atomized individuals, then you can't really have much of a politics. But our political associations are very much like that as well. And because there's been this you know, sort of like it's so important to race to the top and focus on the top stuff, there's been too little attention to what the lower level, you know, county levels, municipalities, and then what's going on in the state. You know, most people don't vote in midterm elections, as you know, right? Because they don't really care about that sort of thing. But those are the most important in many respects. And so I think de Tocqueville, now, I don't think de Tocqueville would say we can actually turn the tide on this in any sort of like national way. Instead, what we would do is we'd focus locally on trying to improve things within our area and trying to get our kids involved in organizations and try to make sure too that they don't get co-opted by politics. You know, so if Boy Scouts of America or 4-H or pick whatever other thing you want for that should be engaging in some sort of non-political habit and mindset formation becomes all about politics, then you got a real problem. You know, there should, in de Tocqueville's view, there should be some sort of, not a rigid distinction, but there should be some sort of distinctions between political organizations and non-political organizations, you know.
Okay, so having like some sort of balance in a person's life, that there are, I guess, other eggs in the basket, so to speak, is what
I'm hearing.
So people get worked up because they don't control the presidency or this house. And what I'm hearing from you as well is you look at some of these situations where, you know, either party is expected to gerrymander, and it's more about a Machiavellian approach to politics rather than agreed upon rules of fair play. Like, nothing's really out of bounds as far as, okay, we're going to try to construct these things fairly no matter what party is in power. But then taking this power, like gerrymandering the congressional districts, trying to make get somebody elected president, we're losing sight of how we can be involved in our communities, not just in political organizations, but just also civic organizations in general, that, you know, are trying to do things to help the community.
Yeah. And that polarization that you're talking about, one of the real danger signs is the fact that these two political divisions, Democrat, Republican, and the coalitions that they represent, which, you know, are pretty arbitrary and don't cover most of us Americans in many respects. The shoehorning of non-political organizations, institutions, discussions into that is really harmful, because it precludes possibilities for association. I'll give you an example here locally. You know, we have this MKE, which means Milwaukee Mythicist, right? And it started out as a sort of very broad spectrum skeptics, atheists association here in Milwaukee. And I don't belong to it, but I've interacted with them. And at one time, you know, they would get involved with the, you know, atheist versus Christian debates and stuff like that. And they'd get together and read stuff and talk and, I don't know, have potlucks or whatever. And they have a podcast too. And, you know, that's a typical, you know, what Locke would call a voluntary association, what de Tocqueville would call an intermediate association. It's not particularly political, although it could, you know, lead to some political things. But they're primarily interested in talking about why atheism is right and why Christianity is wrong and all that sort of stuff. And then it became politicized, not along primarily party lines, but along cultural politics lines, when the atheist community started to fragment along lines or questions like, you know, should we be furthering social justice, or are social justice warriors the problem? And sort of there was a point where en masse, the people who were on the left just abandoned that organization. And then the people, and it had to do with I don't know all the ins and outs, but it had to do with Sargon of Akkad, who's a very polarizing figure and part of the, you know, he's on the right, you know, how you want to classify him would I think depend on what sort of system you're using. But in any case, all these other people are like, well, if you're going to have him in here in the conversation, we're done with the conversation. And so the organization then becomes essentially massively shifted to the right. And they're not going to have the same sort of conversations that they did before. They still seem very committed to, you know, free speech and open dialogue, but there's definitely a different tone there, you know, that you can sense. And so they become, you know, the main option. And so they had, you know, they have their MythCon here in Milwaukee, and they bring in a lot of people primarily on the right, with a few people on the left to, you know, provide some, so they can have debates. And it's the kind of crowd where you know, you can look around the crowd and listen to their conversations, because I went as an observer, and tell where they're coming from, and that it's kind of narrowed, you know. And so de Tocqueville would look at that and he'd say, well, see, that's a problem. You know, or you know, maybe we have more organizations, but that organization now has become, you might say, colonized by politics.
Colonized. Yeah, that's a good word for it, because that's the thing. I know plenty of people who are atheists and agnostics, and they have different political views. And yeah. And it's something you've mentioned on previous podcasts, I believe, the whole idea of having a monopoly on justice and thinking in terms of that I can't associate with these people because of a shared interest. Because when I think back to my high school days, I was always part of the debate team. And of course, that's one organization that seems kind of friendly to people with different views. Yeah. And, you know, my politics have evolved a little bit here and there. I still consider myself right of center, but in high school, I was like very arch conservative, and there were people who were on the other side of things, but it was always endearing to have discussions with these people, and nobody ever assumed bad faith. Which, of course, now, of course, now, if somebody is, you know, somebody voted for Trump, or if somebody, you know, doesn't agree on this issue or that issue, then, you know, they're the problem, they're the enemy, and I can't even engage them on a social level, which I wonder how are debate teams doing today, because it might be a bit more difficult. But I think that that's a good
question, and actually that's something you should follow up on and ask some debate teachers, both at the high school and the college level, how things are panning out, whether the kids are coming in equipped to like tackle. I mean, one of the things you have to do is debating. They'll assign you a side. You've got that side. You've got to speak for it, even if you don't agree with it, right? Can the kids do that as well today?
Yeah, you know, because you do have to, you know, it's just this is your side, and it's really an empathy development kind of, because you have to look at this from another perspective and make those arguments, and you realize that the people making those arguments, there's a reason why they do those things. Yeah. And, you know, somebody actually, Greg, I don't do Patreon yet, but I've thought about it, but there's the whole thing that's blown up with that, the Sargon of Akkad that you mentioned.
I lost some patron supporters over that, and they do exit interviews with them, and the exit interviews are people saying, "Oh, you banned Sargon of Akkad, you know, screw you." And I'm, you know, and I'm reading the exit interview, and I'm like, "Man, you dummy! I'm not Patreon, you know."
Yeah, that they're penalizing.
So
people like you are getting penalized because of this, and I know some people have said, you know, Jordan Peterson, you know, Dave Rubin, people that don't really need the platform as much and can go somewhere else and have this massive following, they have this privilege of being able to say, oh, I'm going to go somewhere else now. But with people like you and me, that's something that's there. And for me, the person that brought it to my attention, and I'm a big advocate of free speech. I think that the line should be generously set. But then I asked the guy who brought it up to me, I said, well, the particular stuff that this guy said, I know that as an educator and somebody who makes YouTube videos oriented toward education, that, you know, Greg, if you had used that kind of language to refer to people, I would not be able to have a podcast with you. You know, I wouldn't say, oh, I've got Dr. Greg Sadler who, you know, uses homophobic slurs and the N-word to make his points. And it's like I do think that there have been times when these corporations and social media platforms have been very arbitrary in who they've decided to ban.
Very, very much so, yeah.
But I do think in this case, it's like we're looking at things on a case-by-case basis. I thought, you know, I can understand why a corporation would say that we don't want to be associated with someone who uses this kind of, you know, this particular kind of rhetoric. It didn't seem to me as much that it was because of his ideas as much as, okay, look, now, of course, they found some rope to hang him with on some obscure podcast, but then again, he gave it to him. And, you know, but then again, so for me being somebody on, you know, right of center, you know, I try to look at things like that and think, you know what, we can look at this on a case by case basis instead of what, you know, I mean, I consider myself an individualist, but, you know, when you noted this whole idea, when individualism just gets to the point where there's no aspect of community standards, we have a bit of a problem.
Well, and so I would say three things. One is that it's very important that both sides police their own. You know, when liberals are attacking conservatives for whatever hypocrisy they're doing or vice versa, that's not as convincing and not as important to somebody like me, or I think to Tocqueville, as when conservatives are holding conservatives to their own standards or liberals are holding liberals to their own standards. So, you know, the fact that, like, so Sargon and you are further right than left, it probably is more valuable for people on the right to say, yeah, this is way over the line, than for people on the left to do it, right? Because then there's less sort of automatic, they're just saying that because they're opposed to them. The second thing I want to say, going back to what you were saying before about, like, the debate capacity and being able to, like, countenance the existence of the other side. You know, we throw this word fundamentalist around quite a bit. What distinguished the original fundamentalists in the early 1900s from other conservative Christians, like evangelicals or Pentecostals, was the fact that they thought there were certain things that were so fundamental to Christian belief that if you didn't buy into them, you weren't a believer. And here's the second most important part, you could not have fellowship with anybody who didn't agree with that. So they dissociated. So that's why for a long time, fundamentalists wouldn't have anything to do with evangelicals. They're like, you guys, you know, you maintain fellowship with the wrong people. And the fundamentalist mindset, you know, sort of lowercase f, is not just about literalism. It's about this sort of exclusive us versus them mentality and this notion that you can't have fellowship or dialogue or whatever you're going to call it with people who are not on the same page as you. And I think that's a real problem. So the third thing I'll mention, again, with the polarization and this sort of infection or colonization of non-political things by the political, think about dating apps. There are so many people now on dating websites or apps who say, I will not date a Republican or I will not date a Democrat. I don't want them in my mix. And so that's a terrible sign. Because, you know, there aren't going to be any sort of Arnold Schwarzenegger, Maria Shriver things coming out of that where there's a productive tension. Instead, you restrict your pool of people that you're even willing to consider right off the bat to those who share the same political views. And or at least say that they do, because they could be complete hypocrites about it. You know, there's many men who are, you know, supposed feminists who are very predatory. And there's many people who, you know, claim to be all for traditional values until you actually look at their personal life. But this notion that somehow it's okay to exclude everybody from the opposite framework from, it could be based on some experience. Like, well, I tried dating a bunch of Democrats, didn't work out. I tried dating a bunch of Republicans, didn't work out. I doubt that's usually the case. I think it's much more likely that people are just saying, I just don't want to deal with people who don't see the world the same way that I do. I won't consider having a romantic relationship. I won't consider sitting and having conversation over a meal with them. And that seems really problematic to me.
Well, because I think back, you know, we mentioned George H.W. Bush earlier. You probably remember the 92 campaign where you had Mary Madeline and James Carville. They were strategists on the opposing campaigns, and they end up falling in love and getting married. And
well, they're
that
both
was
very pragmatic.
Yeah. And the thing is that, I mean, I just looked it up before I mentioned this, that to make sure they're still married as far as Wikipedia knows. And the thing is, what would happen if there was some sort of thing like that between two campaigns today? Like, I don't see it happen, but I remember it was something that was kind of cute in the middle of this election that could sometimes get a little dirty because politics always gets that way. But, you know, this idea, and like you're saying, the colonization in a way that, you know, because there are two people who could be compatible as friends, as, you know, lovers, as, you know, spouses, significant others. They could be compatible in everything except for their politics. Or it could be that they're actually very close in their political philosophy, but just a simple issue or two drives them to the other side, and they might agree on most things, but they say, oh, if you voted for this person, I don't care why you did, can't talk to you. And so the thing is, from what I'm hearing from you here, Greg, that I think is helpful advice for people, is to get involved in not only, like, you know, don't just get bent out of shape that your party doesn't control this house or this government. Like, start going, you know, find out who you're, you know, how you can get involved locally, politically, and actually maybe exercise some power in being able to change some things, because there's this feeling of powerlessness that comes with losing, and you just kind of move on and kind of get bitter about it. But the other thing is to join some organizations that are not political, that might put you in contact with people who think differently, because the research that I've read that seems to be coming out is that trying to dialogue with people online about politics, it's not helpful at all. And but at the same time, actually dialoguing with someone face to face and in person is extremely helpful to develop empathy, even if it's not working on an online medium, because we see somebody face to face, we acknowledge their humanity and realize, oh, I've got, you know, it's just like in the 90s, you know, when it was like, I've got a friend who's gay, you know, and it was just very like kind of, you know, hush hush. But then as the more that happened to people, we saw that, you know, just cultural attitudes toward same-sex relationships began to change a lot, just because of that personal element, and people could associate actual individuals with something that they had previously disagreed with.
Yeah, being in social situations where people are not allowed to like break up into their own little cliques, you know, and ignore everybody else, that plays an important role in not, it's not overcoming those divisions, right? Because the divisions don't go away, but in, you might say, defanging them so that they don't become just poisonous. To sort of bring it back to de Tocqueville, one of the worries that he really had is of what he called soft despotism. And he said that, you know, the tyranny that we have to worry about is in democratic societies is something very different than old school tyranny, where you've got somebody on top and they just use authoritative power and they crush you. Instead, it's that we treat the state almost like a parent that we go running to, or a teacher, you know, little Johnny, you know, hurt me. Won't you do something about it? And we don't actually develop agency of our own to deal with the fact that we're going to have to address conflict. Now, you know, there probably are a lot of cases where we do have to blow the whistle, or we have to organize and petition the government. But there's this tendency, and it's not just the government. It's also, you know, you see this is a big problem in universities, where people are, you know, sending letters, or not letters, emails to the deans and higher ups saying, I want my professor fired for doing this, you know. It's this mentality that you, instead of actually like dealing with things on the ground, you go immediately to the authorities and you have them create some new rules about stuff. And, the authorities might even sort of, and this is what happens in corporate environments quite often, they might even like proactively, we say, you know, come up with a bunch of rules. Like, I'll give you one example. So one of my students in my business ethics class this semester, we were talking about virtue ethics and how it would, you know, play out in business. We're doing a review for the final. And I said, well, you know, temperance could be an issue. Think about the office Christmas parties that you're going to be invited to fairly soon. And, you know, how many drinks should you have? And we had a conversation about, it's two the proper limit? Is three the proper limit? You shouldn't drink six, you know. But you shouldn't, you know, unless you're like abstaining for some reason, you should have a drink with your colleagues and coworkers. One of my students sent me a memo from the place where she was working. It was 2 pages long. And it had all these listings about how you were supposed to comport yourself with respect to alcohol at any sort of public event where it was a company-related event. And it was so prescriptive, you know, it got down into the nitty-gritty. It was in small font, you know, in some places. And I thought to myself, wow, you know, who put this together? Who sat down and like thought out? Now, some of it, of course, is because of abuses, right? You come up with policies when people have really screwed things up. But does it have to go into that amount of detail? And I, you know, that's sort of an example, very trivial example, of what the soft despotism that de Tocqueville is talking about. Because then you just follow the guidelines. You don't have to exercise any prudence, develop any prudence. You don't have to ask other people what they think about things. You just follow the rules and you'll be okay. But you don't develop as a person. And when we try to cover every situation like that, or when we have the government or whatever other administrative thing like a corporation doing that for us, then we don't learn how to manage ourselves, and we just become more and more isolated. You know, we don't form these lasting, important relationships that help form us.
Well, and I guess when you're looking at some of these policies, whether it be a corporate policy or sometimes these, I mean, we've seen Congress pass legislation that the public, you know, the Congress people haven't even read it, much less as the public had time to review it and give comment. And with these corporate policies as well, it's not like they're being they're a product of people voting or a consensus among the employees, but really just more of a, okay, the higher ups got together with the lawyers and decided
They come from the lawyers. They come with a little bit of input from the higher ups, but the higher ups usually don't want to be too involved in that. It's HR that drives it. And you know, we now have in universities, HR has become its own specialized field of studies. So you can get a degree just in HR. And if you think about what that involves, it's not about event planning anymore, stuff, you know, morale boosting. It's about all these intricate procedures and forms and best practices that are supposed to run the workplace.
Wow. Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, even in the workplace, it seems like, okay, yeah, you just go in there, you follow the rules. And even though we live in a free society, we really encounter a lot of situations on a daily basis where things are beyond our control, and we just pretty much accept that, maybe except in these, you know, these political circumstances. But yeah, that's the idea of the soft tyranny, I think, is something that I need to continue to think about. You know, yeah, that's it. But thanks, Greg. I think we've probably pushing on an hour on this one, which, you know, it's always good to talk to you over here. And it's good to think about de Tocqueville's overall philosophy. So we've got the idea of soft tyranny, also the idea of getting involved in political and non-political organizations as being essential to a healthy democracy. And what else did we put out there?
And not just to a healthy democracy, sort of big picture, but to the development of individuals as individuals who are not just these isolated, you know, consumers, you could say, but people who can form genuine relations with other people. So it's tied with the human good, you know?
Yeah, so it's not like, you know, you look at all of these online forums where the people in these forums never see each other face to face. So seeing people face to face, joining organizations, you know, one thing that I thought about is, as you were talking, was when we were talking about debate. The thing is that debate rounds are always decided by a judge, and you don't necessarily know that judge's philosophy or political leanings. And so you had to figure out a way to make your case in a way that made sense and could really make sense to anyone and could, you know, you could build consensus around. Which now there's really no judge except for the people who come and hit the like buttons and the upvotes and all of that kind of stuff. You know, a bit of chaos. So I think that you know, I should think about what I can do to promote debating societies among young people, because I think that's something that we see a lot less people participating in today than, you know, when I was in school. So
I think you're right. Instead, you know, we see massively expanding choir. When I went down to my, this is, you know, a little bit more time, but I'll mention this. My kids live in rural Indiana, and I go down to their concerts, and I'm just amazed at how many kids there are on stage for these tiny schools. And you know, part of it you can attribute to the popularity of Glee and Pitch Perfect and those sorts of things. And they do complain still that, you know, the athletic department gets more money than the music department gets. But there's been a massive increase in that. And I think you're right that that debate has become more and more peripheral. Think about what choir involves or what athletics involves. Everybody's got to do the same thing. You know, you do, each person does have their part, but it's all part of a larger global thing. It's not so much about engaging with another person as opponent. You know, athletic, you've got other people who are opponents from other schools, but and you might have scrimmages. But it's not about learning how to make a case to somebody. It's about stuff that is more, in some respect, luxury products. You know, it's fun to sing. It's nice to listen to music. But it's not absolutely essential to American democracy. It's cool to watch people play sports. Again, not absolutely important to American democracy.
You know? But yeah, I see what you're saying here with that, because with a choir, just like on a football team, everybody's got their position that they play, you know, or in the band or something like that. Now, and also it does get competitive. The school where I teach has won state championships. They go to festivals and they compete with other choirs. But yeah, it is that these are the rules. You fall into these rules and do what you're told, and nothing wrong with participating in choirs and athletics. It's good to watch the game. It's good to listen to music.
And
but
some leadership in those, but it's not the same kind of leadership as would be involved in debating.
Well, and see, that's another thing that I think when we, you know, one other, this could be a whole other talk in itself, but the decline of baseball versus football. When you think about it, I mean, baseball among the big three sports, I feel like it is the sport that emphasizes individual performance more than anything else. You know, it's like everything's everything's riding on this one person at bat, or if the pitcher can strike this guy out, and you've got this, or if the center fielder catches the ball or trips and drops it, and it's so focused on what does this individual do, what is an error here, even though they're part of the team, they're really functioning as this individual person, and they don't have the rules against. You know, you go to football, excessive celebration, in that sort of thing. You know, baseball doesn't have a penalty for excessive celebration that I know of. I've never seen it called. And so, you know, we can see with that another sort of thing here to where we are sort of gravitating even in our entertainment. You know, we would rather watch, people, you know, beat the hell out of each other on the football field, but do it in a way that, you know, what the team's doing matters so much more than necessarily what one individual is doing. Now, that's an oversimplification, I'm sure. Somebody's a football person, but...
I mean, I'll actually bring up something from, again, my home state. So, I mean, we have one of the best quarterbacks of all time in Aaron Rodgers, but we haven't been able to surround him with the kind of team that would actually allow him to have the sort of consistent performance of, say, a Brady, because the rest of the team really does matter.
You know? Yeah, well, I don't know if Brady is the best person to bring up this year. they've had a rough time.
Yeah, the Patriots.
But they did for a while. They did have it, and it wasn't just Tom Brady. He had all the people to back him up. Yeah. So yeah, with that, you know, hopefully Americans listen, and anybody else listening to this podcast, some people do that listen internationally, and I think that's great. So hopefully this brings us into 2019, determined to maybe think about an organization that you can join that maybe, you know, stretches your comfort zone, puts you around people that whose ideas may be a little bit unfamiliar and maybe even a little bit scary, maybe not too scary, because there are some organizations we don't want, you know, we would not want to encourage people to join. But Greg, thank you very much for joining me again. Always good to hear Dr. Greg Sadler, Gregory B. Sadler on YouTube and ReasonIO.com.
Thanks. Glad to be back.
All right. And Happy New Year, everyone.